My name is Deanne Lagerquist, and I'm delighted this week to be on teaching staff. I've been here already 4 weeks this summer working in the registration office as a semi-trained assistant, which was also a great delight when I'm not at Holden. I teach at St. Olaf College. I'm in the religion department. I'm also the director of our alternative BA program, which is a program called the Pair College. It's a program that students design their own program. So it's a great joy to come here, and if I know the answer to the question, to be able to say, here's the answer, and if I don't, say, come back when Judy or Maggie are here, rather than being the person in charge. And there may be some relevance in that to what we're going to talk about this evening. I'm doing a series called Friends of God. The series title really springs from this summer's theme, No Longer Strangers, and I hear that as an incomplete sentence. Obviously, it's an incomplete sentence, it doesn't have all the right grammatical parts, but also it suggests no longer strangers, so then what? And that's, please take a Bible, Pastor Briel. That suggests why we're talking about friends of God, and tonight we'll be doing this a little bit differently than we have in the previous two, and we'll do in the next two sessions, in order to really focus on the theme of today, the Jubilee. We'll do that in these sort of three or four parts. I'm going to say a little about friends of God and saints. I'm going to say something about the concept of Jubilee, and that's why you're all sitting here with your finger in Leviticus 25. Then I will talk to you about two or three saints who I think represent the ideals of Jubilee, and then I hope to have done that briefly enough to give you opportunity to talk about saints you know who help you to live or to even imagine the possibility of living the ideals of Jubilee. So that's our agenda. There's a staff meeting here at 7, so we will not linger. Okay. I'm perfectly willing to be interrupted, challenged, etc. So here we go. Jubilee Saints, Friends of God. Friends of God is a term that I take from several sources, and I'll say something more about that at another point. But the one place that the phrase comes from, and I know some of you have come in today, so let me read you the whole sentence from Simone Veil. This is when she's writing to a Catholic priest who is her friend and teacher, describing the benefits she's received from her friendship with him. She says, having already thanked him in the specific, moves on to this more general statement. For nothing among human things has such power to keep our gaze fixed ever more intensely upon God than friendship for the friends of God. It's a different way of thinking about what we are called. We are called Christians, taking Christ's name upon ourselves. But here's another way to think about what does it mean to be one who follows Jesus, to be friends of God. And what Veil is suggesting here as well, I think, is that when we look at others who are friends of God, we learn something about the one with whom they are friends. And as I said at another point in this series, this, of course, we know from our human relationships. We see it happening all the time here at Holden. Someone will come up to me and say, so-and-so from my congregation back home asks me to bring you greetings. And immediately I know something about this person, right? I know that this person has the good sense to be friends with somebody I already like. And so it's a good recommendation. What takes a while to find out is at what point we join together. Because it's certainly the case, and I probably should be ashamed to admit, that there are people who are friends of mine, who I don't like. No, yesterday we talked about Ignatius and the practice of self-examination and the sins that reside in us, and I confessed yesterday to being impatient. Now I have confessed to something else, so maybe I better move on. Okay, but we and others see God in the friends of God. And that's true not only about those of us who are ourselves friends of God, but those who don't know God, who haven't come to know Christ, who haven't lived with Jesus, come to know who our God is by how we manifest a holy and godly life. They get a sense, and we all know this in the negative, you know, when you say, well, my God is a God of love, and immediately they're in there with the Crusades and the Inquisition, you know. I'm like, well, but it's not the whole thing. People are looking for the deeds or for the fruits, right? We know God by the fruits that the trees in God's orchard bear. So what are the friends of God like? One of the things I think is important to say about the friends of God is that we're not all alike. We don't all bear apples or pears or kumquats or mangoes or whatever it is that we bear. We are different from each other, but each of us is responding to Jesus' command and his appointment. He gives us a task to love one another. And that's another place where this friends of God phrase comes from, is John 15. When Jesus says, I no longer call you servants, but friends. Because the servant doesn't know what the master is doing. He also says there, you didn't choose me, I chose you. He says in those few tight little verses, 12 to 17, no greater love is there but that we lay down our life for our friends. He commands us to love one another. So presumably, these commandments, this is my third point about what the friends of God are like, presumably those commandments could be twisted into a different kind of sentence, and instead of being commandments, they could be descriptions. What are the friends of God like? The friends of God are people who love one another. The friends of God are people who lay down their life for one another. The friends of God are people who fulfill these commandments. So if you go from commandment to description, it sounds different in our ear. We all bristle at what we are told to do, what we are required to do. But if instead we have that sort of Mission Impossible language in our mind, your task, how does that go? Your mission, should you decide to accept it, is to love one another. Okay, so that much about friends of God's and saints. Jubilee is an exciting way of thinking about what it means to be a friend of God. The friends of God are Jubilee people. What is this Jubilee? Well, it's astonishing. It's something we've started to pay attention to at Holden these last two summers. And I'll tell you, it's sort of infectious. It gets into the way you think. And I think one of the reasons is that it doesn't sound so much like a commandment, and it sounds more like an invitation. Something to be glad you have received, an appointment, right? I appoint you ambassador to Japan, or, you know, something to be sought after. Another answer to the question, what is Jubilee, is to say it's Sabbath squared, right? It's Sabbath intensified. Dan Erlander's delightful book about the Bible, Manna and Mercy, he says, in describing this, first, the Sabbath day is the seventh day of the week, and then there's the Sabbath year, the seventh year, and then the Jubilee year, the 50th year, the grand Sabbath year. So it's 7 times 7 years, the 50th year, 49 plus 1. But it's not simply numerically Sabbath squared. It's more intensely Sabbath. It's a commandment about how to be God's people in a world that is redeemed and yet still longing for the fullness of God's reign, when we will live wholly by God's rule. So I've said before in this series, I've used this little thing I say to my students about, we live on Gilligan's Island. Right? The shipwreck has happened and we're waiting to be rescued. And after a few days of sitting on the beach and eating coconuts, you realize you have to organize a garbology detail because the stuff is piling up, and then it starts to be the rainy season, so you need a house. And then you discover that people get cranky when the four-hour tour turns into 4 months, and you start to make a world. But you're still always hoping that someday you'll get to eat something besides coconuts. That's the world we live in. And Jubilee is, in my view, a way of helping us live between the times. Now, to go back to the Sabbath, why do we have the Sabbath? There are two reasons that we read in Scripture. One is because God rested. After creating for 6 days, on the seventh day, God rested and delighted in all that God has made. And so we, in imitation of the one who made us, stop and rest and take delight in all that God has made. We acknowledge in that God is the creator of time and that God is the creator of work, that these are not ours, right? And one of the wonderful things about time, I think, sort of tangentially, is that although most of us in the late 20th century are always scurrying around saying, oh, I wish I had more time, I don't have enough time, if only to get more time, the truth is, of all resources, it's the one that everybody gets the same amount, at least to start with, right? There's nobody can give me an hour of their time. Sometimes I waste it, but everybody gets the same 24 hours. So that's one reason. We have the Sabbath because God rested. And we have the Sabbath because God redeemed the people of Israel out of slavery into freedom. Once you were slaves, and now you are not slaves. So even when we're not slaves, we have to work. But only 6 days. On the seventh day, remember, you have been made free. You have been led out of captivity, whatever that captivity is. Not everyone finds their employment to be a form of captivity. Some lucky few of us have the kind of jobs where you say, I can't believe they pay me to do this, right? Or at least sometimes we have those jobs. Not everyone has those kinds of jobs, but some of us do. Other things maybe hold us captive. And on the seventh day, to remember that the captivity is not ultimate. I want to say a third thing, which is not a biblical reason for the Sabbath, but one that comes to me in the wake of listening to one of my teachers use this concept, not Sabbath, but the concept of an exemplar. Martin Marty, in his essay about Dorothy Day in this little book called A Tremor of Grace, Contemporary Writers on the Saints, uses the image of exemplar, or an a way he has used it other times. It seems to be one of his favorite things. You know, if you read someone and know someone well, you learn what they do over and over. Well, he has latched onto this notion of an exemplar, or an exemplum. He says, the medieval dictionary related the word exemplum, something cut out, to a clearing in the woods. Those who think about the exemplum say that it gives definition to the woods. Think about where you're sitting. Without it, there would be no beginning and no end to the thickness of the thicket, the darkness of its plotless, pathless way. One cannot see the forest for the forest, so someone cuts out some trees and creates a clearing. Here the woods momentarily end, and thus we define them. They become the woods. Further, a clearing is a place, oh, listen to this, where the light falls. Cultivation occurs. A cabin beckons hospitably. So it is with exemplars. Then he goes on to talk about saints, which I'm not to that point yet. But I think the Sabbath, the notion of a Sabbath or a Jubilee year, is like that, especially for those of us living on Gilligan's Island. Right? It's a moment to say, it doesn't always have to be in a hurry. You don't always have to be impatient. You don't always have to feel responsible. You don't, you know, whatever it is that becomes a burden rather than a duty, which is also a delight. We have this time to say, this is what we aspire to, even if I can't always do it. At least once every 50 years, we could try. Okay, so Leviticus 25 is where we find this concept. So some of you already have your finger in it. I am not so well prepared. Those who were here early are numbered off. Those who weren't, just pick one of those paragraphs. But let's all read together first 1 to 7. And I'm just going to read it out because I know not everyone has a Bible. This is after the people have been brought out of captivity. They're going into the wilderness. They're trying to kind of figure out. God is trying to explain to them, now that you're not a slave, now that you're at liberty, how are you to be in this world? So try and think of it not just in commandment language, but also a description. The Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land that I am giving you, when we get where it is we're going, the land shall observe a Sabbath for the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in their yield. But in the seventh year there'll be a Sabbath of complete rest for the land, a Sabbath for the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. You shall not reap the aftergrowth of your harvest or gather the grapes of your unpruned vine. It shall be a year of complete rest for the land. You may eat what the land yields during its Sabbath, you, your male and female slaves, your hired and your bound laborers who live with you, for your livestock also, for the wild animals in your land, all its yield shall be food. So there's a sense of fruitfulness that's part of it. Now just take a few minutes to read through your little paragraph and think about what other things are characteristic of this Jubilee year. The 50th year. How do we know when it's a Jubilee year? What are the people doing? Okay. What else happens? How else do we know when it's the Jubilee year? What are the people doing? Just call them out.
Returning property.
Returning property to whom?
To the person they bought it from.
Okay. Boy, that's weird. I just bought a new house. I'd rather keep it. What else?
Release the slaves.
Release the slaves so that they are set at liberty themselves. Yeah, what else?
They are eating of the abundant crop of the sixth year.
Yeah, so they're not starving. It's not a time to sit around and be gloomy because I had to give back my house and my slaves are off visiting their family instead of waiting on me. What else?
It sounds like they prorated the cost of selling their property so that if you were at the beginning of the cycle, it would cost more, but at the end, you would sell it for less, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess in those days, didn't they also divide the land up that they owned to their children? And wasn't there that going on also?
I'm sure there was some sort of inheritance scheme that's part of it, yeah. One of the things that strikes me about this little formula is you're giving it back or you're redeeming it, but it's not without regard to what happened during those 49 years. course, the other way to look at it is to say, now, isn't that just like human beings? It's a great concept, and we have to figure it out to the last penny. I don't know quite how to respond to that. I have both responses. Other things you want to say about this Jubilee year? If you'd been lost on a mountaintop or something and you came back, you've lost track of the years, you'd be able to tell it was the Jubilee year because these things are going on.
Well, the trumpet sounds.
The trumpet is sounding. Susan said in her sermon this morning that Jubilee means loud noises. Mm-hmm. All that scurrying around, blowing the trumpet, maybe even rejoicing. Now, she also said in her sermon that we have no evidence that anyone ever actually did this, which is an unfortunate and sad thing. But that's no reason that we can't let it infect us, that we can't say, well, it's a good idea. Maybe its time has come. I think about this especially when I think of Jubilee being Sabbath squared. The Sabbatarian movement in the United States, the one that is why we don't have mail delivery on Sunday, and why when I visited my cousins in Pennsylvania when I was a teenager, we couldn't buy a Clue game or Risk or something, some board game we wanted, we couldn't buy it in Pennsylvania on Sunday. The blue laws, those things that regulate commerce and other kinds of activity, tended to be pretty grim, right? To keep a Christian Sabbath meant to sit quietly and with good posture in your chair and read the Bible. And it didn't sound, in its worst character, very delightful. And certainly no loud noises. And yet, I think we've probably come enough generations away from that, that the notion of a clearing in the week and some ways of being that mark off the friends of God become attractive. I talked about this last summer with a friend of mine, a colleague at another college, and he said, you know, that's true. My grandparents, he said, kept that kind of Sabbath. And for me, the heaviness that afflicted my parents has evaporated into nothingness. And it's so easy to let the day be like any other. So too, the 50th year. Well, maybe the problem with the 50th year is that it's too big. Maybe we need small Sabbath practices, small Jubilee practices. Okay. So, the themes of Jubilee. I've picked out three that I think are really important. The notion of release, restoration, and rejoicing. I think I've got my grammar parts mixed up there. But all of them are about setting at liberty that which was bound. This is a kind of liberty that is not what we have on the 4th of July these days. Okay. It's a liberty that has a particular theological base. So verse 55, everyone together, please. I close my Bible so someone else will have to start us off. Ron?
For to me, the people of Israel are the servants.
They are my servants, whom I brought out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God.
That's the basis of this liberty. God is our Lord. We are servants. Well, we're also friends. You get that tension there. And certainly, in Christianity, we mix those together. That beautiful song we're learning from more contemporary hymnody, "Let me be your servant." The practices of Jubilee are not because it's good time management, it's more productive. You know, everyone knows that if you take a rest once in a while, you're more productive. That's not the point here. It may be a payoff, but it's not the point. It's a side effect, not the cause. The cause is because God is God, and we are God's creatures, the work of God's hands. That's why we do this. Okay, and the three things, release, to hold loosely what is not mine, but rather God's, and thus to set both that thing and myself free. Okay, not to clasp hold in a way that makes me not able to enjoy the trip because I'm always worrying about I'm going to lose my plane ticket and my passport. Have ever happened to you? You're so worried about the arrangements and how we got our hotel reservation and where are we going to have lunch, and suddenly the trip is over. What happens to me, it's happened to me a few times giving a party. I have a vivid memory. When we first moved to Northfield about 10 years ago, we at Northfield, our fall festival is not Jubilee, it's the defeat of Jesse James Days. They teach the children in school very carefully to say the defeat of Jesse James Days, but usually it comes out Jesse James Days. Well, we had just moved to Northfield, but we lived in Minnesota before. We had a lot of friends. We wanted them all to come. We invited them down to have a dinner, and I was busy, and I made three kinds of pasta salad and two cakes and, you know, this huge spread. And suddenly everyone was gone, and there I was in the kitchen weeping because I didn't get to talk to anybody. I was so busy feeding them. Yeah. Right? To let go of what's not ours so that we're not captive to it and so that that thing can be free. Okay? If you have slaves, well, have you read much about the American South before the Civil War? The fear? Or think about South Africa not so many years ago. The fear that you have as you cling to something you think you own, but which really isn't yours. To set free. I think of three quick connections to this. One, of course, what's happened to these people historically when they come to Leviticus 25 is they have been set free, right? Finally, Pharaoh, not because he thought God was God, but because he was so sick of it, finally let them go. So release, because you have been released. I think also of the parable about laying up stores and where is your treasure. So if we were going to do a whole series of Bible studies where the themes of Jubilee come through, I think that parable, you know the one I'm talking about, don't you? Yes, I see some heads nodding. About not laying up treasures that will rot and burn, but in heaven. And I'll make another little confession to you that I lose a lot of things. And I have found, actually, it's a very salutary thing when I lose stuff, because it's an opportunity for me to stop and say, nothing earthly lasts. I don't own this. And I assure you I have many occasions to recite that to myself. We also say it in the offertory. It comes in the liturgy, at least in some.
This is now the feast.
Now the feast. We joyfully release what you have given to us. Yeah. And it's a lovely image. We just let it go. And it can go back where it's supposed to be. Okay, return or restoration. What's meant here? It's not simply setting free the slaves, which we read about in 25, but also to return things where they belong, to restore what was. And this, I think, is very important for us, that we realize the world is broken, that things are askew, right? That the doors don't quite shut, that we don't do the good that we thought we should, that we know we should. It's a redistribution. Right? It's a redistribution, passing it around, as it were. And that's partly what happens with the land in that Leviticus 25 passage. The other antecedent here, of course, is manna. Remember how it worked with manna? It came down, and you went, and you took How much? Enough. It's like those old recipes, right? A handful, a pinch, a... Who knows? Well, what's enough? Well, it fills you up. Not too much, not too little. Enough. That's the redistribution that we're after. It's eating the yield of the field, but leaving enough for gleaning, as Ruth did when she ran along the edges and took the extra, so that those who don't have a field will at least have food. In the New Testament, I would think of the miracles of feeding many with a little. Right? And again, that's a release, and then there's redistribution. The little boy who comes and says, well, it's not much, but here it is. And then it feeds everyone. Rejoicing. Here I would say the theme is to complete our proper work, which we've begun in releasing and restoring, to complete our proper work with praise and celebration. That simply to release and restore is not to have done the job, if you will, the job of Sabbath. Because the job of Sabbath is like God to delight in all that God has made. Not just to look at it, but to say, it's good. It's good. So, Miriam's song, although we might not like the militaristic images, you know, but we probably like the tambourine. Okay? They got across the Red Sea, and Miriam leads the people in a dance. Stop in your being released. Know that God is the one who is victorious, and don't worry about who's getting stuck in the mud. In the New Testament, I think of the parable of the lost coin and the woman who found it. Now, I already told you that I lose things a lot, so you might imagine that this is one of my favorite little pieces of biblical text, and it's one that my son knows. He says, tell me about the woman with the coin, Mama. Because he knows that occasionally, if I've lost something that I really cared about, and then having said, well, and then I found it, I'll go and buy him balloons and say, rejoice, the lost is found. And if I rejoice over my lost car keys, how much more does God rejoice when we let go of what isn't ours? And know that God is our God. Okay, well, all of that about Jubilee. And now I want to speak very briefly about some saints, some friends of God, who point us to particular pieces of this ideal. And then, as I'm talking, listen to me with one ear and think, you don't think with your ear, listen to me with half your brain, and with the other half, be thinking of people who you know, living or dead, who inspire you to release, restore, and rejoice. You don't have to know them personally in the flesh for that to happen. Okay, the first is Francis of Assisi, everyone's favorite saint, right? Francis, as I'm sure all of you know, lived in the 12th into the 13th century in Assisi. He was the son of a textile merchant. And that's important, not just because of his family, but because that's what was happening throughout all of Europe. The growth of a mercantile economy, the beginnings of the end of the Middle Ages, the beginnings of having currency instead of having to drag 80 wagons of hay in to be able to buy something. I mean, having a cash card has really given me a sense of what that meant. To be able to have a letter of exchange instead of all that stuff. I mean, bring all your jewels in a big box. The idea of, if not conspicuous consumption, at least a little more than enough. a little extra. Two suits of clothes, one for good and one for every day. Now, I don't want to suggest that that's a terrible thing. Please understand me. But it was a change in how life was being lived. And Francis is not alone in the sorts of ideals he lifts up to his contemporaries. There were others, not all of whom ended up being venerated as Francis did, and that's a long point of scholarly study, why Francis makes it and Juan Valdez doesn't, and, you know, but we don't need to worry about that today. I think what we do need to say is that Francis's emphasis on poverty and preaching as the apostolic life, the life of the ones who are sent by Jesus, is appropriate to his time. That poverty was a kind of setting free. That it was to say to people, you don't have to be caught in having more than enough. He did that with preaching. Now, his contemporary, Dominic, who started the Dominicans, tended to emphasize the preaching and poverty as a way of giving credibility to the preaching. I'm oversimplifying horribly here, please forgive me. Whereas Francis emphasized the poverty and preaching explained why. That's verse 55, right? Why? Because God is God and we are not. He encouraged poverty. Three things I just want to mention, because I know you all know a lot about Francis anyway, is the mendicant tradition, the begging tradition, is a form of redistribution. It's not just that the one who gives to me when I beg has redistributed, sort of like voluntary Robin Hood, but it's also a redistribution in contrast to the Benedictine and Cistercian model, in which the order owned things. So that there was poverty. I was personally poor, but I got to live in a great place, and I was never hungry, and I had plenty of clothes, and right? So it's a different way of being poor than what had been before. And it emphasized about Jesus his poverty. And that was a controversial thing. Any of you who have read or seen the film of The Name of the Rose, that's one of the subplots in the background, this notion of Jesus' poverty. A second thing is that the Franciscans, as the order matured, began to make a distinction between use and ownership. This is a tricky business, perhaps even a slippery slope. And that's why the Franciscans keep having reform movements. When I was in graduate school, I went away once for a few days, and I had my own apartment my last year in graduate school. I decided it was going to be the big splurge. I was taking out a bigger loan. I was getting my own place. I'd been sharing an apartment with three people in earlier years. The previous year had been long. I ate so much soggy quiche. This guy said he could cook. All he could make was a soggy quiche. So I had my own apartment. And one of my classmates was a Franciscan. From the province, which is in the western part of the United States, and they were quite strict. He could only go home once a year. If somebody died that many, didn't get to go home at Christmas. He was studying for his exams, and I said, would you like to have the use of my apartment while I'm gone? And there was that image, right? Didn't belong to him. He didn't have bigger loan payments like I did, but he got the benefit of it. Now, if we can think about all that we have as use, not ownership, we've learned something very important from Francis and his fellows. And it might make me think differently about losing stuff. If it's not mine that I'm losing, but somebody else's, might make us more responsible as well as less gripped. You see the difference between responsibility and clutching? Okay. And then a third thing that we know from Francis is his acute awareness of the community of the whole creation. Preaching to the birds. thinking of sun and moon as his siblings. The beautiful Canticle of the Sun, one of the first pieces of poetry written in Italian, not Latin. What does it mean when we think of Jubilee, not just with property and people, but also with the whole creation? Well, today it meant planting flowers, right? On the one hand, creating a clearing, if you will. Okay. These are meant to be making your mind go, right? So you're thinking with half of your brain who you're going to put up here. Susan reminded me of a woman very influenced by the Franciscans, Elizabeth of Hungary. She appears in our calendar of commemorations in the Lutheran Book of Worship in November or October, I've forgotten which. She turns out to be sort of a contemporary of Francis. He died in 1226 and she in 1231, but she was very young when she died, in her 20s. She was a princess. She was married to a member of the aristocracy of the time, and she gave away her dowry to feed the hungry. She gave away her time and her status to help found a hospital, actually just outside of the castle of Wittenberg, where Luther was running from the emperor and he was hiding there and translating the Bible. Well, that's the same area where Elizabeth lived. And she was very influenced by the Franciscans. She had a Franciscan spiritual director. So for her, releasing meant literally giving things away, and eventually it led to her early death. Someone more from our time is Dorothy Day. I forgot to say, there's also a nice essay about Frances in here. I'm not going to read to you from that. But in reference to Dorothy Day, Marty says something I think very useful as we think about these saints who are our teachers. He says, all saints are other. And we tend to like them and stories about them because of their difference from our world and our ways. Saints always come from far away, usually in time and space, but also in their achievements. I can't imagine doing what Dorothy Day did. And I'm sure most of you know quite a bit about Dorothy Day. She's the figure who died, a woman who died in 1980. Born in the late 19th century. She's the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, which included houses of hospitality, feeding poor people. I mean, essentially, that's what it's about. Making soup and bread and coffee day after day after day after day after day after day after day, and giving it to people. It's really very mundane, and I expect tedious. They tried to have some clearings, places in the woods, farms where people could go for refreshment. You know what she found out about those places? Annoying people kept coming to live at them. Extraordinarily annoying people. People who didn't have the vision. And again, not as many times as she made soup, but many times Dorothy Day would leave it behind and release it and say, it's not worth a fight. We can go somewhere else. There was also, of course, the newspaper, the Catholic Worker newspaper. And you can read excerpts of this. There's lots of books about Dorothy Day over in the bookstore, and I didn't bring any in particular over. But to explain why. Not just to give out food, because lots of people are willing to give out food. Lots of people are willing to make soup and bread and coffee and give it to people, but to explain why. And then she also was involved in politics and in a certain way. I mean, she was not running for office or anything. Larger structure. And that's important. There's a tension with the Jubilee between what I do myself and changing the society. We read this often in the 19th century in the United States. among people who had slaves or whose families had slaves. And how do you deal with that? Samuel Simon Schmucker, whose name you may or may not know, but a very important figure in 19th century American Lutheranism, was very opposed to slavery. He married a woman whose family had slaves. He'd served in Virginia, he served in Pennsylvania. It was a big struggle for him to figure out how to do that. And he negotiated it with his wife about what they would do with these slaves and when they would be set free. How would that all work? Now, I didn't mean to talk about Lucretia Mott, but I can't talk about the 19th century and anti-slavery without saying something about this woman who is one of my personal heroines. Lucretia Mott was a Quaker preacher. Her husband was a merchant, and they did a couple things about slavery. They didn't own slaves, but two interesting things they did. One, John Mott ceased selling and trading in cotton and only worked wool. And secondly, Lucretia Mott did this brilliant thing. They made little candies and they wrapped them up in paper that had anti-slavery slogans on them. And she worked to change the laws. They go together. They go together. One more story about, a couple more things about Dorothy Day. A story. It is told about Dorothy Day that one day someone came to the St. Joseph House in New York City and donated a diamond ring. I don't know how big it was, but everyone knew it was a diamond ring. And some of the people in the house thought she should sell it and get the money, because you can make a lot of soup for what you get for a diamond ring, and a lot of coffee if it's not Starbucks Sumatra. I don't know what she did with it. She gave it to a crazy woman who was living in the house who wanted it. And she lost it, I think. But it delighted the woman. It made her happy. It was foolish. It was giving up what she didn't own to someone else. I think two things about Dorothy Day that for me are very important are, one, personal responsibility, and this notion of personalism, which, if you're interested in, I sound like a real commercial for the bookstore, but my colleague Jim Farrell has written an extraordinarily fine book called The Spirit of the 60s, in which he writes about personalism and this notion of taking personal responsibility, not to wait for the whole system to change, not to wait for the government to say everybody is going to have a fair tax, to use your money fairly, right? To take personal responsibility. And with that is what I have learned from reading about Dorothy Day, the courage to do a small thing, not to depend on being able to do a big thing, to fix it all, to take the steps of the 50th year. Because frankly, I know why nobody ever did what it says in Leviticus 25. It's too hard. It's too big. It's too scary. But what about Sabbath not squared? What about, I don't know, now I'm out of my depth in math, but what about the square root of 50 or something? Right? Okay, so.
Sabbath
what?
Light.
Yeah, there you go. If it's in the light of God, fine, yes. So we have 10 brief moments for some people to talk. And the rest, and then when it gets to be 6:58, we all have to go out, and you can talk to each other about who these exemplars are for you as you think about releasing, restoring, and rejoicing, because God is God, and we are not. So, who's brave? Who wants to be first and talk about some person who helps you know how to do that?
I will.
Good.
My person is an 80-year-old woman who's living now in Minneapolis, and she's lived many decades on her own. Right now she's living in a senior high-rise. It's her first one-bedroom apartment. Before, she always lived in an efficiency. And she lives in the middle of downtown, where she sees shootings out her window. And she walks 2 blocks to the hospital where she volunteers 4 days a week. And being in her presence, I love that imagery of the clearing, because that's the way I feel when I'm around her. Mm-hmm. I feel, and I think there are so many people who come in contact with her who feel that way. There's just something about her where I feel I can be myself, and that I know who I am. Mm-hmm. I forget about myself, and it's, I just love to be around her, and so does everyone else. And she lives a very, very simple lifestyle. She gives things away all the time. One example, if she has clothes to give away, she doesn't throw them in a garbage bag and put a twist tie on it. She irons them. She puts them in a box with tissue paper, and then she puts them in the alley in beautiful boxes.
Oh.
And then when she goes to work and then she comes back, they're gone, of course. And I don't know, I could go on and on about Emma.
Yeah, that's a wonderful image of ironing the clothes and making them look beautiful.
I have to say one other thing more about her. I nominated her for a service award. And this was in Minnesota, and she won this. She won $5,000. She gave it all away.
Mm-hmm. Next. You looked like you wanted to be next.
She just reminded me, actually, we've already spoke about her, Dorothy Day, but this, I'll just share this one small story that I always think of, because it's on the theme of giving dignity to people. And the story, I read it, because she's a heroine of mine, but it was the story of a young man who was coming to look at some of the Catholic workers, and he wanted to see Dorothy Day, and he walked into her place, and he was wondering where she was, and he saw this woman sitting down talking with this someone who had come into the Catholic worker, and she was an alcoholic, and it was sort of, in his description, babbling on and on, and he said he saw this woman saying, mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. And listening, and then she looked up at the young man who was standing there, who had walked in, and she said, "Would you like to speak to one of us?" You know, and it was obvious. You know.
Yeah, nice. Others.
There's a man who came to the Twin Cities and walked into our church a while back, and he told me he had a dream, a vision for a company he wanted to start, an idea for a product. And it's been a struggle for him to get this thing started. It's gotten to the point where I had to give him money to eat. But now the dream is becoming a reality. And this fall, the company is getting off the ground. His vision for it of it is that this idea he had is a gift from God. And 10% of the profits from this company will go to the church, setting up a foundation. And you're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars going back into the church because of this gift he had.
I'm sorry to say you have to take this conversation out into the highways and the byways of Holden Village so that the staff can come in and have their weekly meeting. Unless, of course, you're staff, in which case you already have a good seat. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I went so long, because I wish I could hear each of your stories.